Eat Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Searching, Operation Finale, Juliet Naked, The Little Stranger, and Kin. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring a new release of Brain Scan. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news that I want to hit is sort of a follow-up to something we talked about a couple weeks ago, and that is the James Bond franchise lost a director. Danny Boyle was supposed to be directing this new one, and he was fired, and the news had just sort of percolated out there right before I did the show last week, and I had been talking about Idris Elba as a potential follow-up to Daniel Craig. So there's been a lot of Bond in the news, but the news that Danny Boyle got fired for creative differences, a lot of people were wondering, wait, was that Daniel Craig who did that? Were there other actors? Where was it? The rumor that's out there right now is that Barbara Broccoli, who runs Eon Productions, her father, Cubby Broccoli, brought James Bond into its full franchise glory back in the 60s. The rumor goes that Broccoli had wanted a major change in this, and they basically said they wanted to kill Bond. That was the idea that they had for this movie, and Danny Boyle's like, no, I'm not going to kill James Bond. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to be known as the guy who does that. That's, I find an interesting thing, because that's something pretty significant to walk away from, even though Danny Boyle doesn't need it. Danny Boyle's a brilliant director and does a lot of great things. But what bothers me about this is something I was predicting when Skyfall came out, because Skyfall was an unprecedented success for James Bond. James Bond has always been a big franchise ever since the 60s. It started in 1962, and with some stumbles in the 90s as they were trying to get the franchise back on its feet, most Bond films have done very, very well, but they've never been mega hits. They've never been the biggest grossing movie of the year. They've just been a good, solid franchise, posting decent numbers. It wasn't until Skyfall happened that it became a billion-dollar movie franchise. And I said at the time, you can go back and find the old episodes where I'm like, you cannot expect every Bond movie to make $1 billion worldwide, because that is setting the bar so high. And like, if you look at like what Marvel does, Marvel figured out how to do franchises. When they have the big movies like Avengers, but Ant-Man and the Wasp, it did a couple hundred million in the States, and it's going to be like 500 or so million worldwide. It's not at the level of Avengers, and then no one's expecting it to be. But if you say, you know, Skyfall did so well, ergo Spectre must do so well, and then Spectre didn't do as well, that's not a failure of the franchise. That's just, it's a cyclical thing. You can't expect everything to do the highest that it's going to be. And what they're trying to do, instead of just cranking out something that's a formulaic franchise that did very well for 40 or 50 years, and then saying we need to revitalize it and we need to renew it so it can be this massive thing, and we need to do character development, and we're going to do something, we're going to kill Bond. You can't kill Bond in every episode. Also, by the way, he's been dead before. I mean, there's stuff in like Diamonds Are Forever and You Only Live Twice where he gets killed, but he doesn't really, and he comes back. But you can't reinvent a franchise with every single movie, especially if it's just a run-of-the-mill, you know, cranking out formulaic franchise. You saw that also happen with the Friday the 13th reboot that they did about 10 years ago. It did very well its opening weekend, and then it really went down, and you're like, that's okay. It made more money than most of these movies do, and it's okay to just crank them out, because that's what they did in the 80s. Friday the 13th was a huge moneymaker for Paramount then, because they spent like $1 million on each movie and they made $10 million. They had the Blumhouse model back in the 80s. And that's what you got to deal with Bond, only you somewhere between the Friday the 13th success and the success of every Star Wars movie. So hopefully they'll get their stuff together with Bond and not try to develop it too much and just give it its formulaic spy franchise, which is a lot of fun. And it's essentially what the Mission Impossible movies are turning into. The next piece of news I found really interesting is Louis C.K. had an unscheduled, unannounced stand-up bit this last week, and he got a lot of accolades for it and a lot of cheers from his audience and his fans. But of course, that made the social justice warrior segment of the internet lose its collective mind because, oh my God, Louis C.K., he had sexual misconduct and he fell from grace and blah, 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 blah. He shouldn't be allowed back on stage. Rump, 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 banging the drum. But here's the ugly backlash on the Me Too movement. When you get somebody like Louis C.K. who did act inappropriate and did do bad things, but nowhere near the level that Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby had done. It's one thing to completely excise Harvey Weinstein out of power and have him being taken care of on a criminal matter. Louis C.K. acted inappropriately, but what's the statute of limitations of letting him back into comedy clubs? I mean, we're not even talking about stand-up specials at this point. We're talking about people just accepting him on stage. People aren't perfect. And I said back at the, you know, a year ago or so when he had his little kerfuffle, I said, this is the most Louis C.K. way to stumble into sexual misconduct. I think that he's going to be under a microscope from now on, especially from a business perspective. But I'm okay with him coming back. These were not ruin your entire life and you can never step back in the public spotlight actions. I mean, we have Mike Tyson in movies and that guy's a convicted rapist. So what's wrong with letting Louis C.K. back on the stage? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two movies I want to actually hit are both coming out on October 12th, which I think is kind of funny. I think this is the first time I ever accidentally just picked two that had the same release date. The first one I want to hit, and I don't think I covered this already, and that's Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween.
Look at this. A mysterious disturbance recently took place in the town of Madison, Delaware. Creatures come alive from the original manuscripts of R.L. Stein.
The book.
What book?
It's a Goosebumps book.
It's locked.
Oh, man.
What did you do?
It's time to make Halloween last forever.
I like the first Goosebumps. I'm surprised it's taking this long to make a Goosebumps sequel because it was like 4 years ago, something like that. It was a neat twist on the Goosebumps story without just making the churned out episodes because they did a lot of those on television. In this one, of course, Halloween comes to life, which is kind of cool. And it's a great Halloween type movie. I like the fact that we're now seeing a bunch of horror movies and Halloween movies coming out in October. And that makes me happy because back in the day, it used to be either Saw or Paranormal Activity kind of ruled October and everyone got out of the way. And I like to see horror movies and that sort of stuff get into the spirit of things. There's no pun intended. So Goosebumps 2 is a welcome sight for me. The other one I want to hit that comes out that week is Bad Times at the El Royale, also opening on October 12th.
First time at the El Royale?
You have the option to stay in either California or Nevada.
I always wanted to stay in the honeymoon suite, even though I'm not currently on my honeymoon.
This is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
He lost, Father?
Can I confess something to you? I'm not really a priest.
I've done horrible things.
So's everybody.
This is a movie that I have a feeling, my prediction on this one is actually going to be quite good. Almost like a mid-90s crime thriller. But I don't think it's going to do very well. I think this is just a really hard sell because I've seen the standee for this and the posters for this in my local theater for months. And it gives you no sense of what it's about. It's just a sleazy motel. And it's got a very literal title. It's about bad things that are happening at this motel. But the poster tells you nothing. I think it's very hard to market it, especially by the name, as descriptive as it is. But it's got Drew Goddard behind it, and I really loved Cabin in the Woods, and I think he's a very talented guy. And I'm curious to see what he does with a less supernatural thriller. So I'm looking forward to this. I just have a feeling that this is going to be hard to sell to a mainstream audience. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Operation Finale and Kin. Let the sky fall.
Thank you.
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. The first one actually came out on Wednesday of this week. Actually, Tuesday night, you could have gone and seen previews of it. So it's been out for a couple days. Did pretty well over the week so far going into the weekend. And that is Operation Finale. In 1960, Mossad agents travel to Argentina to capture Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann so he can stand trial for his crimes in Israel.
We have our guy, Adolf Eichmann.
The architect of the final solution?
We should be putting him down like a mad dog.
I would happily put a bullet in between his eyes, but that's not what we're doing here.
My job was simple. Save the country I love from being destroyed. Is your job any different?
This sort of signifies the beginning of award season in my mind, because while we've had a couple movies, and I actually have gotten a couple award screeners already. I mean, in August, I was getting award screeners. I only got two, but still, some of those companies got a real jump on things. But in terms of wide releases, while there are movies that came out before September that are going to be noticed during award season, this is the time where I think we're starting to see movies that could live through award season, although it still is a bit early. But this one, I think, is something to keep your eye on simply because of the subject matter and the performances. The story itself is a fascinating story because post-World War II, a lot of Nazis did flee to Argentina. And so certain areas, especially Buenos Aires, had a certain degree of Nazi sympathy down there. And you have to remember that in 1960, when this movie takes place, it was only 15 years after World War II ended. And also, there wasn't the widespread knowledge of what we know now because of these international trials that took place and the research and investigations there over the last 60 years, 70 years. There have been plenty of data to come out to show what was really happening, but a lot of that stuff was covered up and not even faced, sometimes even by the Germans themselves. It wasn't until the 60s that the Germans themselves as a country really started to reconcile some of this and actually have their own legal approach to it. So Israel, of course, being a country founded with Judaism, they, of course, take this stuff very seriously. And so they went on a big Nazi hunt post-World War II. And this is the story of them going after Eichmann. Now, if you don't know who Eichmann is, he's known, and they even say that in the trailer, he's known as the architect of the final solution. He basically figured out how to make it work, the logistics of it. And it's one thing to have a horrible idea, which is monstrous, but it's another thing to then make that monstrous idea come to life and make it work. And that's why Eichmann was one of their top cards on the list. And this is the story of the agents going in again, because they knew they weren't going to get cooperation from the Argentinian government, and they knew they weren't going to get him extradited, and they wanted him to stand trial in Israel. So in order to do that, they basically had to smuggle him out of the country. And that's what this story is, getting in there, identifying him positively, getting him captured, and keeping him quiet and finding a way to get him out. And that's where the real drama comes in. Now, I'm not Eichmann's biographer, but I can look up sort of like the general points of the story. And I mean, there's liberties taken, I'm sure. And there's some changes that are made just to make the drama work a little bit better, to give it a bit of a rising form of action. But it's a very well done movie, mainly because it shows the dichotomy between the general overall political idea of, well, as Israelis, we have to go after the Nazis. And there's a big picture type thing of them saying, well, they need to stand trial because this guy's responsible for the deaths of 6 million Jews. So we got to put him on trial in Israel. And that's important, as opposed to just saying he's not going to escape justice. Let's just put a bullet in his head. And the personal impact, because you got to remember, this is 15 years after World War II. The people, and there's even a scene where they address this in the movie, where they say, who did you lose? And one guy's like, I'm the only one left. And that's a real thing that happened. I mean, nowadays, you can look at it, and we all know people, whether we know it or not, we all know people who lost loved ones in the Holocaust. But nowadays, today, because we're moving into a time where it's dropping out of our collective memory. I mean, this movie takes place almost 60 years ago, and there are fewer people left alive just because time is passing, and this is going to drop out of memory and into history books. And it shows how personal this was and how you had to separate that personal revenge desire from making this happen for the greater betterment of the cause from a global perspective. And that's, they address that. They address it pretty well in this movie. Now, it has some slower parts, and it does bog down. A lot of movies run into second act problems as they go from the second act to the third act, and then things really pick up. It does have stumbling points in that. But it's very well acted. Oscar Isaac plays one of the Mossad agents, and Ben Kingsley does a fantastic job as Eichmann, humanizing him to the point that he's not just this mustache-twirling villain, that he's a real person that did horrible things. This is not a defense of Nazis by any means, because, my God, they were the bad guys, and they still are the bad guys, and anyone should be ashamed. If you're flying some sort of Nazi flag today, shame on you. We need to remember these are the bad guys of the 20th century, and we can't forget that in the 21st. But when I say you humanize the Nazis and you humanize people like Eichmann, reminds us that these are not just creatures that are spawned from some demonic pit. They're real people that found a way to make it okay with themselves to do these horrible things. And that's where the real monsters are. Because it's one thing to say, oh, well, this is just a straw man. But this is a real person. And he justified this to himself and wasn't just okay with it. He thought it was the right thing to do. And that's real danger in humanity. And that's why it's important to remember them. And there's even a debate in the movie where they say, well, shouldn't we just kill him and not give him a platform? And then another character, I won't say who it was, comes out and is like, no, we can't let anyone forget about this. And that's why this movie's important, because you can't let people forget about what happened, because humans can do this again. And that's the real power of Operation Finale. So I'm going to have to say Operation Finale totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to breeze through this next one because I don't have any time for it. And that is Kin. An ex-con and his adopted brother go on the run with a mysterious and powerful weapon.
Your brother just got out of prison.
I know I've been away for a long time, but I want to make sure that you know that you're important to me.
I want you to be careful around him.
Welcome home, my man.
I know I owe you guys some money. I just wanted you to know I'm not dodging you.
Oh.
Somebody's got to be looking for this thing.
This is essentially, from last week, AXL, which bombed. It is essentially AXL without the dog angle. It's about these people. They find technology, and they're being chased by thugs and soldiers at the same time. This one flew completely under the radar. I don't think anybody cares about it. It's one of the bigger releases, and it didn't even get screened locally. So the heck with this movie. I'm just going to say it has to suck because they didn't screen it. Preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Searching and The Little Stranger. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Searching. John Cho plays a widower whose daughter goes missing, and he must use the clues on her computer to try and find her.
I haven't been able to reach Margot. When was the last time you saw her?
The study group only went till 9.
I think we're gonna go late.
No, she definitely left at 9.
Did she mention anything unusual? Was she acting strange?
She's been transferring funds for the last 6 months. We found blood in the vehicle.
How did David respond?
These problems usually start in the household.
I didn't know her. I didn't know my daughter.
Anyone who knows anything about me knows, and I've said that line almost as much as I've said the following, I hate found footage. I do not like found footage movies, mainly because if it's just 90 minutes of some idiot with a video camera that has to have an excuse to have it on and shooting all the time, it's usually a garbage film. And it's too constrictive of a genre to really be its own genre. It's garbage. Found footage worked once or twice. We need to abandon it. With that said, Searching is an interesting take on found footage because it all takes place through the computer screen. The difference between this and, say, something like Unfriended or just a couple weeks ago, Unfriended Dark Web, is it offers a little more options. There's news clips, there's FaceTime video. It's essentially, if it can come through a screen, it's captured for the film. They do stretch a couple times to make that work. And I'll forgive it for this one because it's effectively done. Now, this is not the first time we've seen this kind of thing. Like I said, you had, Unfriended and Unfriended Dark Web all kind of take place through a Skype chat on a person's laptop screen. And they've done this in other TV shows. Like I remember Modern Family did an episode where it was all Claire was like texting and instant messaging and Skyping people. So this has been done before. I don't see this catching on as much as found footage, which is okay. Cause the last thing I want, I'm not bearing the lead on this. I enjoyed Searching, but I don't want to see a 50,000 imitations and copying of this. And I don't want to see it applied to everything ever done. This is a nice lark for a type of movie to do, but it is not set for its own genre of filmmaking styles. But in the sense it works. Because there are so many different options between calls and him searching and him looking through browser history and contacting the people on our Facebook page. And it's cut together and edited well enough so it's not just trying to strictly keep everything that's on this locked computer screen. So the film itself, the idea is a basic missing person story. And it works for a couple reasons because it works in this new era of social media and such exposure to people's lives. And the fact that teenagers put everything, I mean, teenagers and high school kids, they put everything online. Not all of them, but there's a lot of them that any, you know, I'm taking a poop, you know, I'm eating sandwich, all that kind of stuff. It's going to be online and they've got pictures and video and Snapchat and live feeds. But it also shows that even somebody who puts everything online doesn't reveal their true selves. In fact, most people who live on social media will put on a good face on social media. They make themselves look better, or they don't put the really terrible stuff, or they don't put the stuff that's their sort of, it's their fault about. And they do keep things to themselves. And that's what makes this movie interesting because obviously the father and daughter relationship has been strained because a mother passed away. She dies of cancer right at the beginning of the movie. So that's part of the setup. And you know, it's the story of him realizing that he doesn't really know his daughter that well anymore. And he's got to do his own detective work. And he's finding things he may not want to find. And he's going into territory that is uncomfortable, but it's what he needs to do his own detective work. And it has enough twists and turns. Now, I predicted most of them, but then again, I watch movies for a living. So it's not hard for me to figure out what's going on. But I mean, it's like I said, it's effectively done. And it is more than just the what would you do if it was your own kid missing, because every parent can relate to that, and it's horrifying to think about this. But it's topical for today, and I think it's also something that a parent can watch and connect with in that sense. But a teenager could watch it as well and think about it from their perspective. I imagine that teenagers and parents are going to look at this from two totally different angles. And they're each going to get something out of it. And that's, I think, where the real sort of, you know, rubber meets the road in terms of making an interesting movie. And also, you know, I think it's interesting that I saw one person so far point out that I know of, and I didn't scour the internet for this, but just people I know. Everyone's going on and on about Crazy Rich Asians. Oh, it's all about Asian Americans. Well, this is about Asian Americans too, because John Cho, he's, you know, and his daughter, they're the main characters of the movie, and they're Asian Americans. So, it's, while it's not being heralded as the Asian American movie, which Crazy Rich Asians is, I think it's neat that you have a certain degree of diversity as well in casts. And nobody scoffed at putting John Cho as the lead to this one because John Cho's a doggone good actor. He's come a long way from the Harold days. So I'm going to have to say Searching, it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is The Little Stranger. This gothic mystery follows a doctor attending to a family living in a home that might or might not be haunted.
Why don't you tell me what's going on?
You wouldn't believe me.
They brought Caroline home to nurse him.
I'd heard they were troubled. Very hush-hush about it. A long time ago. Who's this child here?
There's something evil in this house.
That's nonsense.
Bertie, what are you doing here?
You rang for me, miss.
I did not.
Well, Mrs. Ayres was upstairs.
Rang itself. Did it?
I love horror movies, and I love gothic horror movies, too. I know they can be a little bit slower. I mean, it's something like Crimson Peak is sort of like that ultimate in gothic horror, where it's really done, in terms of modern gothic horror, does it over the top. But I mean, like, I love the old Dracula movies, and that sort of almost leaning into this Victoria era. Now, this one takes place in 1949, but it all has that gothic feel to it. And there's been periods of studios trying to bring back that gothic feel. You had that with The Woman in Black, that one starring Daniel Radcliffe that was, oh gosh, 7 or 8 years ago now. These things are not always done effectively. They're not always done to the point that they're great movies, but I like a little bit of difference in it. The problem I have with this movie, that while the atmosphere's fantastic, and it really nails that gothic feel, and the acting's really good too. Domhnall Gleeson, he's very dry, but he does a decent job acting. Ruth Wilson plays the daughter in this, sort of this creepy family in this weird house, and she's great. Will Poulter's in it, and he's got a smaller part, but he's very good in this movie. People forget that he's actually, I think, from the UK initially, so he's using his original accent. Charlotte Rampling's in this. I've been saying to people to describe it, I say it pulls its punches before it throws them. And I'm watching the movie and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not even annoyed that they're not making a case on whether it's definitively haunted or not. I'm annoyed that they're not even addressing it. I'd say 70% of the movie is just uncomfortable, awkward, interfamilial relationships and kind of boring. It's sort of like if everyone had died in Downton Abbey and was haunting a house, that's basically what this is. It's very boring characters that you think should have an interesting life. So, yeah, I mean, I struggle to stay awake during this movie because it just gets dull. And while the atmosphere is cool, you cannot make an entire movie based on atmosphere. And it was funny because I have been very critical of certain high-level horror thriller movies. I was very lukewarm on Hereditary, which everyone says, oh, it's the scariest movie. I saw an article, or at least a headline, somebody says, it's been scientifically proven that Hereditary is the scariest movie ever. And I'm like, that's hogwash. First of all, there's a whole rash of articles out there that say, proof says, research says, science says. And you can say whatever you want to. Science says that the internet claims are all true. You cannot make a movie with just atmosphere. And that's all this is. And yes, it's based on a best-selling book. It's just dull. And it never quite recovers out of its dullness to make me even moderately interested in it. So I'm going to have to say The Little Stranger sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Juliet Naked, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Brain Scan. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with Juliet Naked. A woman finds herself in an unlikely friendship with a reclusive music star who is the idol of her ex-boyfriend.
Tucker Kroll, one of the most unsung figures of alternative rock.
Hasn't been seen in 20 years.
Has a new album. And I don't want to spend my time with someone who doesn't get it.
Well, somebody new. Juliet Naked is a naked attempt to squeeze a few more quid out of a long dead career.
You wrote this.
You read that review I posted.
You nailed it. I couldn't have explained it better myself. Tucker Crowe.
Tucker Crowe, as in Duncan's idol, Tucker Crowe.
Yeah, it's really me.
What's your story?
This is one of those movies that it kind of is its own subgenre. It's about the idolatry of a certain, you know, in celebrity, but also in specifics, a musician. Now, full disclosure, I'm not a crazy music fan. I like music, and there's a lot of different music I like. I generally do not have the obsession of music that some people do. So those kind of movies tend to annoy me when there's somebody who is so obsessed, you know, sort of the fan-based film. That tends to annoy me. But this one doesn't fall into that trap. And I think that's great because I think it expands it outside of that music idolatry type of movie. This also works really well because of the cast. Chris O'Dowd, who's best known for stuff like The IT Crowd, he was in Bridesmaids, he's in the Get Shorty TV show. You've seen him around a lot, and he's very funny. He's has a certain degree of success, but I've always found his stuff from like The IT Crowd, I always thought he was great as Roy in The IT Crowd. But this one channels that sort of nerdy, obsessive, compulsive character that he's really good at playing. And so he's good even though he's a minor player. But the big stars, of course, are Rose Byrne, who's always adorable in everything she does, and Ethan Hawke. And I've got a lot of respect for Ethan Hawke. Yeah, I know he came out and said that superhero movies are hogwash. And now you expect that from somebody who's not in a superhero movie. The people who speak out against superhero movies are always the ones who aren't picked to play a superhero and who aren't directing a superhero movie. That's fine. Ethan Hawke can find them to be hogwash. And I have a lot of respect for Ethan Hawke. I used to not really like him as an actor, and I don't like everything he does. But he spent his last like 20 years doing a lot of obscure stuff and independent stuff and stuff that he finds interesting. And he could have capitalized on being a big movie star, but he kind of left that. You know, I haven't seen him in big movies. I mean, yeah, he was in stuff like Gattaca, but that was like 20 years ago, and he was in, he's been in other big films, but he's really kind of retreated into doing the independent stuff, which I think is neat. You know, more power to him to do some alternative and stuff that he finds interesting. And you get a movie like Juliet Naked, but it's also doesn't turn into an ego piece for him where he's like, I want to play music and let me play the piano. There's a couple scenes where he does that, but it's not like, it's not him just trying to be a musician himself. He's actually playing a character in it. The other thing with this movie is it takes place in England, and Ethan Hawke's character is an American who travels there, and he ends up meeting Rose Byrne's character. They're not in London. They're in a smaller sort of seaside town, so it has that quaint British atmosphere to it that differentiates it from sort of like the underground club scene for musicians in America, even though there certainly is an underground club scene in like London. But it sort of mixes that guy living in kind of in the boonies in America with, you know, sort of the smaller town folk. It's sort of like Doc Martin's, maybe not as small as that town, but if somebody in Doc Martin's town had an obsession with his musician. But it's also not as a pretentious movie. It's light and whimsical at times. It's very sweet. It's also got a lot of truth to it. And it doesn't get overly morose or bogged down in the character's own neuroses, which works for a film like this. So I have to say, this is kind of a charming movie. I was surprised that I liked it as much as I did. So I'm going to have to say Juliet Naked kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Boy, did the Happy Time Murders stink in the box office. It didn't even make $10 million its opening weekend, which was lower than anyone was already expecting, and it wasn't expected to do well. Crazy Rich Asians is still doing well. On its second week, it made almost $25 million. It's predicted to make $25 million over Labor Day this week. So that's more interesting to note, is the staying power that each week, and this will be like the third week in a row. Now, granted, it's a four-day week this weekend, but each weekend it's posting a, you know, mid-20s number, which that's tough for a movie to do. You know, opening with $25 million or so is okay for some films and big for some smaller ones, but to sustain that for three weekends is actually kind of amazing. AXL is, it came in at number 9, and it's going to sink fast, and I think it's going to take Kin with it. We'll see what happens when everything shakes down next week, because there's a lot of movies opening or expanding at least this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Shout Factory, or Scream Factory's, release of Brain Scan, a movie from the mid to late 90s. Edward Furlong stars as a teenager caught up in a virtual reality video game that might have made him into a murderer.
Brain scan, the ultimate experience in interactive terror.
Never leave home without it.
You're in the game, man. You're in control.
You must think like a killer. Cover up any clues. Leave no witnesses, no evidence.
It was so real. It was sick.
See, I told you, man. I told you it'd blow your mind.
What was on that disc?
It's not a game anymore.
Hamilton and Hayden.
It's real.
It wasn't supposed to be real!
I remember watching this movie back in the 97 or so was when it came out, 97, 98. And I never saw it in the theater. I saw it on VHS. And I never thought it was a great movie, but it really sort of quintessentially encapsulates this kind of horror movie from the 90s, where it was still had elements of 80s filmmaking. It's sort of this business of this kid home alone. This reminds me a lot of the movie Trick or Treat, not the anthology movie, but it was from the 1980s, like 1986. And it was about sort of this troubled kid who finds, he connects with heavy metal music. This was back at the time where heavy metal was really associated with horror films. And that's less now, but that was something that came out in the 80s and certainly into the 90s. And the character in this one, the trickster, which is this sort of virtual reality game master who comes out of the TV and interacts with Edward Furlong, he's great, but he's just as a cliche of a heavy metal type of horror icon as you can get. But he is very recognizable, and he's a great face for the movie. Much better than Edward Furlong, who, you know, this was post Terminator 2, where he was trying to figure out what he's going to do, because he was in a huge movie, but he could never capitalize on much of a career after that. And of course, now the guy's in his, you know, 30s or 40s, and I don't know what he's doing. Probably working at a Walmart somewhere. But this was still when he was young and still kind of fresh and still had a potential career, but he was already slumming it into these small budget horror movies. It's not a great movie. There's a lot of stuff that it has a twist to it that is okay. But the problem is that if you watch the movie, it doesn't quite jive with the twist. It's one of those where the twist kind of comes as a twist that seems almost thrown in at the end. The most notable thing about it as a writer is it was the screen debut of Andrew Kevin Walker, who ended up writing Seven. He was the one who wrote this. And that's, again, sort of like how Return of the Living Dead Part 2, I talked about that last week, how that Blu-ray is, it's not a great movie, but it's great to get the new Blu-ray because it has such good special features. And some of the guys who worked on the effects of Return of the Living Dead 2 also worked on the effects of Brain Scan. And it's clear that they took this from similar interviews. They kind of had them sit down and talk about Return of the Living Dead Part 2, and then they had them talk about Brain Scan because they're wearing the same clothes and the same behind-the-scenes features. But that's great. I love getting extra features on a Blu-ray. They just didn't port over the features from the original DVD release. I mean, there are some stuff that's in there. You know, they've got the old deleted scenes and behind the scenes footage, but they've also got a new commentary with the assistance of the director because the director passed away. There's also new featurettes about the screenwriting. It's an interview with actor T. Ryder Smith, who played Trickster, and they've got a new interview with the guys who did the effects. Like I said, they also did that of Return of the Living Dead Part 2, and an interview with composer George S. Clinton, who worked on the score for this one. And that's what kind of makes this one neat because, like I said, it's not a great movie, but it does have that 90s nostalgia the way some movies I watch have an 80s nostalgia that didn't have to kind of fall into that PG-13 garbage territory that we get a lot with the Blumhouse collection. And so it all comes down to when you take the package together is the movie and the special features. I'm going to say that Brain Scan kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other releases this week include Upgrade, Book Club, American Animals, RBG, The Flash Season 4, and Lucifer Season 3. And that is it for this week. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about The Nun and Peppermint. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.